Good afternoon, everyone. I am Rachel Sowell Silverman, Director of Public Relations for the American Association for Cancer Research. I want to welcome you all to the AACR NCI EORTC International Conference on Molecular Targets and Cancer Therapeutics being held here in Boston. I also want to welcome those who have joined us by phone. This is the second of two media briefings for this conference. Today, we will hear from three presenters. After each presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask a question. If you are on the phone, please be sure to press star 1, and an operator will connect you at the appropriate time. As a reminder, all abstracts lift embargo at the beginning of their respective sessions. Embargo times have been listed at the top of each press release, but a quick reminder. Dr. O'Sullivan Coyne's abstract lifts embargo on Tuesday, October 29th at 11:50 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Dr. Ho's abstract also lifts embargo on Tuesday at 11:50 a.m. Dr. Yanni's abstract lifts embargo today at 4:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I also want to note that a complementary study on MRTX 849 will concurrently publish in the AACR's journal Cancer Discovery, also lifting embargo at 4:15 p.m. today. If you would like a copy of that manuscript, please reach out to myself or Matthew Burns. And for those in the room, I chose not to print the lengthy study to save a few trees, but by all means, come see me after the briefing. If you are on the phone, you are welcome to follow the slides, which we provided you via email last night as well as this morning. And if you're in the room and forgot to pick up slides, they are with my colleague Sarah, located at the entry. We are very fortunate to have our three scientific co-chairs of the Molecular Targets meeting with us at this briefing. And I should also note in our slide deck is their disclosures. Our moderator for today will be Dr. Bill Sellers, who is a core institute member of the Broad Institute of MIT and professor of medicine at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Harvard Medical Center in Boston. I would also like to recognize our conference co-chairs, Dr. James Scully from the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, as well as Dr. Emiliano Calvo, who is a director of START Madrid Group at CIOC in Madrid, Spain. And now I would like to turn it over to Dr. Sellers, who will be moderating for today.
Thanks so much and welcome, everyone. I think you can see from the three abstracts that we've decided to highlight, the theme is targeting the RAS-MAP kinase pathway. This has been sort of one of the holy grails of cancer due to the high frequency of RAS mutation in tumors such as colorectal, pancreas, and melanoma. And seeing the tremendous progress over the last several years in this pathway led us to think that having these interesting clinical trials presented together would be quite exciting for you. So without further ado, I'll introduce Geraldine O'Sullivan Coyne, who's a staff clinician and at the Developmental Therapeutics Clinic at the NCI, and she's going to present a phase 2 trial of the MEK1-2 inhibitor selumetinib in adults with neurofibromatosis type 1 and inoperable plexiform neurofibromas.
Good afternoon. I will be presenting this study tomorrow, and I will point out that for this presentation, I'll be using NF1 to signal neurofibromatosis type 1, and inoperable plexiform neurofibromas will also be referred to as PNs. And this is an intra-NCI collaborative trial, and my disclosures are noted here. To be able to better describe the trial, I'd like to give some additional context with regards to the clinical characteristics and the cellular background for this particular disease. So neurofibromatosis type 1 is an autosomal dominant disorder, which affects approximately 1 in 3 to 4,000 patients, and it is caused by a mutation, either inherited or sporadic, in NF1. The clinical characteristics of these disease occurs early in childhood with caffeolae spots, Leish nodules, and neurofibromas, but patients also experience complications such as hypertension, scoliosis, and epilepsy. And additionally, they are at an increased risk of both malignant and benign tumors occurring at an increased frequency throughout their lifetimes. Neurofibromas are benign tumors that occur as a growth on a nerve. And when these occur in cutaneous nerves, they're referred to as cutaneous neurofibromas. And when they involve more than one fascicle of a nerve, they're termed plexiform neurofibromas. And these plexiforms, or PNs, are locally invasive tumors that can cause debilitating complications, including pain, disfigurement, and functional limitations, and are a huge source of morbidity for our NF1 patients. When they occur in sensitive areas, such as the airway or in the spinal canal, surgery is the mainstay of therapy, but they tend to recur and can also malignantly transform into malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors, which are a form of rare but highly aggressive soft tissue sarcomas. The NCI Pediatric Oncology Branch has had a natural history protocol for a long time now, looking to better understand this particular disease. At a cellular level, we know that for NF1, the disease is characterized by activation of the RAS pathway, and in this case, NF1 functions as a negative regulator of the RAS-MAP kinase pathway, and the loss of the same is postulated to generate dysregulated signaling across this particular pathway, RAS, RAF, MEK, and ERK. Selumetinib, the agent that has been studied in this trial, inhibits the MEK enzyme in this pathway, and selumetinib has recently been given breakthrough designation based on two early phase studies that have shown unprecedented response rates in the pediatric population with NF1 and PNs. However, we do not have any clinical pharmacodynamic data noting MEK inhibition and consequently phosphoric modulation as the mechanism which so far is what we believe causes the anti-growth effects of selumetinib, because this type of research intent biopsy is not really performed in pediatric trials. Given these considerations, we have an ongoing phase 2 study of selumetinib in adults with NF1 and inoperable PNs, and this is a open-label Simon two-stage study enrolling patients 18 and older that have inoperable PNs and at least one PN-related morbidity. And the primary objective of the study is to evaluate the response rate of selumetinib using 3D volumetric MRI. We also incorporate extensive pharmacodynamic evaluation of serial biopsies of both PNs and cutaneous neurofibromas, and we have extensive patient-reported outcomes incorporated into this trial as well. A total of 26 patients have been enrolled between the ages of 18 and 60, and tomorrow we will be presenting data regarding the first 21 patients enrolled on study. We will also be showing data that notes the majority of patients have experienced a reduction in their PN volume, as well as significant improvement in various PROs and pain interference scores. I will also be detailing the response criteria that has been utilized to evaluate the changes in PN volume, which we believe will become standardized across other trials that are performed subsequently in this patient population. Additionally, we will be sharing data to show that the PN core biopsies and as well the cutaneous neurofibroma shave biopsies have been able to yield sufficient protein for the evaluation of the candidate biomarkers that have been developed for this study. These particular biomarkers have been developed by the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnoses, and the SOPs for these are freely available. Additionally, we will touch on the type of toxicity that has been seen in this study, which will be important given the fact that we administered selumetinib in this trial in a chronic and continuous fashion. However, with this particular slide, I think it's hard to show the level of complexity of this study, which has actually called upon multiple levels of NCI expertise and resources, partially because of the novel approach where we're looking to assess outcomes tailored specifically to a patient's PN symptoms. What I'm trying to say with this is the fact that PNs or target PNs vary between one patient and another, and therefore the assessments are highly individualized. In summary, we will be demonstrating evidence of clinical benefit without excess or irreversible toxicity in this population studied to date. We will also be noting the biopsy is feasible and safe if performed additionally in a serial fashion and is crucial in order to be able to further clarify the pharmacodynamics of selumetinib and the mechanism of action of this agent in this population. And also to very much highlight that this is an ongoing study, so these are preliminary results, which is also important bearing in mind that some of the secondary objectives, which include PRO-based analysis, are carried out and change and assess. And are assessed over time. However, we would also like to very specially acknowledge the patients and their families who've partnered with us. As I've mentioned, this has been quite a complex study, and we very much appreciate the patients that have come with us on this journey, particularly in the cases of severe morbidity. And many thanks. This is the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sullivan-Coyne. Are there any questions in the room? And let me remind those on the phone to please press star 1, and I'll be able to see that you have a question and call on you. Any questions first in the room? Yes, Annette. Please press your button to talk.
Ah, there we go. Annette Brindle from BioWorld. I'm a little surprised. I don't know much about neurofibromatosis, but my impression of RAS deregulation was always that it's that it has very bad my impression of the neurofibromatosis patients is that the tumors, and I don't mean to minimize at all how debilitating they are, but to my understanding, they rarely turn malignant and they rarely metastasize. Do you know why this is different from other RAS tumors?
That was partially the reason why I was hoping to give a little bit of additional context in introducing this particular study. With regards to the fact that these are not typically malignant tumors, this genuinely does not, I think, note the degree of morbidity associated with these gigantic or growing lesions, which even though they're not malignant and do not typically metastasize, as are locally invasive and compress on very crucial structures, genuinely have been very difficult to try and treat. With regards to the fact that the RAS activation in this particular disease is something that has been determined preclinically is part of the reason why we have been so careful with regards to the pharmacodynamic assessment and the biomarker assessment in this particular study, trying to clarify indeed if this is the biological mechanism of these particular pathway in the disease. The data, the bulk of the data that we have is coming, of course, from preclinical cellular type setting rather than the clinical setting as such. There is one other element to bear in mind for this particular trial, which is the fact that the selumetinib in this trial is being used at a dose that is lower than technically the recommended phase 2 dose in adults in advanced malignancies where selumetinib has also been tested. So I think there are a number of unanswered questions still, which we hope the study will give us further clarity on.
So maybe I could just also comment on part of your question was, you know, KRAS mutant tumors are very aggressive. But that's not the only mutation in those tumors. So those are very complex, late-stage human tumors that have KRAS plus lots of other things. And we know from work for many years that if you just mutate KRAS in primary cells, those cells are not carcinogenic right away. So I think there's also a difference between early and very late mutations.
In many cases when the, and this is coming a lot from the natural history protocols, we know that morbidity rises over time with these tumors. So by adulthood, a number of patients may have multi-level cord compression and have, as I said, significant morbidity as well as pain and disfigurement coming from the disease.
Are there any other questions in the room? Okay, I'll turn it back to Dr. Sellers.
Okay, our second presentation is by Alan Ho from the Memorial Sloan Kettering, and he's going to present preliminary results from a phase 2 trial of tipifarnib in head and neck squamous cell carcinomas with HRAS mutations.
So I just want to thank the organizers first for the opportunity to discuss our preliminary results of this ongoing, of this trial in this forum. And just by way of background, tipifarnib first is a drug that inhibits the farnesyltransferase enzyme and indeed was the first compound developed in this class, which we refer to as FTIs. So over two decades ago now, FTIs were originally developed as a biologically rational way of targeting oncogenic RAS mutations in human malignancies. And it was really based on the observation or understanding that even mutant RAS needs to localize to the plasma membrane in order to initiate its oncogenic activation. And farnesyltransferases indeed catalyze a key step in that process, and so it was thought to be a therapeutic vulnerability and a way to target RAS. Unfortunately, the initial clinical trials that were done that presumably enriched for RAS mutant tumors or solid tumors didn't show significant activity at that time, and then the development of FTIs for cancer therapeutics. However, in terms of the why, there have been several lines of preclinical evidence suggesting that while NRAS and KRAS are susceptible to certain biologic processes that allow them to circumvent FTI action, indeed HRAS mutations are not susceptible to those mechanisms and are thought were predicted to be particularly susceptible to FTIs and tipifarnib. And so us at Memorial Sloan Kettering, this became an area of interest for us when Jim Fagan's group published similar observations in both mouse models of skin cancers and thyroid cancers. And so we were very enthusiastic to work with Kura Oncology to develop this phase 2 trial, which was really meant to test a hypothesis that clinically HRAS mutant solid tumors are more susceptible to FTI action or tipifarnib, and so that's what I'll be sharing some of the results with you today. So these are my disclosures over the last 10 years. So in terms of the original design of the study, again, this was a study that was designed to test tipifarnib in incurable HRAS mutant solid tumors who had resist measurable disease and pretty good performance status, ECOG performance status of 0 to 1. The initial study design was to evaluate this separately, individually, into two different cohorts. Cohort 1 was a thyroid cancer cohort, designed because of our preclinical data in thyroid cancer models. And then cohort 2 were HRAS mutant solid tumors of any other type. This cohort 2 was later amended to focus specifically on head and neck cancers because of the early significant signals we saw in that disease type. And the initial dosing for tipifarnib we used in this study was 900 milligrams orally twice daily on an every other week schedule. So depicted here are just some of the initial results from the first 17 head and neck HRAS mutant head and neck cancers that we treated. What we saw were really rapid and durable responses among this group despite resistance or to chemotherapy, cetuximab immunotherapy in previous lines. What we also noted was that a subset of patients would need dose reductions of tipifarnib, and indeed by the end of cycle 1, the median dose that patients were being treated with was not 900, but indeed 600 twice daily. And importantly, what this graph demonstrates here is when we looked at the HRAS allele frequency of the patients we treated, we found that all of our major responders that are depicted in the dark blue there were really relegated to those who had an allele frequency of 20% or greater, and indeed even more enriched in the 35% or greater cohort. So based upon these initial observations, the trial was subsequently amended. We extended it to 30 head and neck cancer patients, and we limited enrollment to those who had at least a variant allele frequency of 20% with a good performance status, and starting the dose of tipifarnib at 600 milligrams twice daily to make it more tolerable. And then also added a third cohort to the study where we wanted to evaluate the efficacy of tipifarnib in the setting of non-head and neck squamous cell carcinoma patients. So the data that we're going to present at the conference this year is really the outcomes of the 18 evaluable HRAS mutant head and neck cancer patients with at least a 20% allelic frequency of HRAS mutations. In this group, the median age was 64, two-thirds were men, and the majority had a primary site of their tumor in the oral cavity, another quarter in the pharynx, and then larynx and other sites. This was a very heavily pretreated patient population with a median of two prior anti-cancer regimens. Almost all the patients had previously received a platinum agent. Over half received immunotherapy and cetuximab as well prior to enrollment on the study. Here's the bullet point efficacy results from the trial to date. So among the 18 patients, we've seen 10 major responses, many of them quite deep, as you can see on the waterfall plot on the left. This is depicted in the dark blue. The other 8 patients had stable disease, and importantly, the starred bars you see there are actually patients with unconfirmed PRs where we're waiting to confirm a major partial response on subsequent scans. And noteworthy here is in a very heavily pretreated patient population, no patients had progression of disease as their best response. As you can see in the swimmer's plot on the right, many of these responses were quite durable. Again, the major responses are in the dark blue, with 4 of our major responses lasting for over a year, and indeed 6 for at least 6 months. And you can see that 2 on the bottom there with the arrows demonstrate that some of the shorter intervals that we've seen are patients with ongoing, who are on drug and still on therapy. The overall response rate in the end at this point is 56% among these first 18 patients. So in conclusion, the conclusions reached so far here is that we have very compelling anti-tumor activity in a heavily pretreated cohort of these recurrent metastatic head and neck cancer patients with HRAS mutations, an overall response rate of 56%. I didn't show you the data here, but we will be showing this data tomorrow at the presentation, that among the patients who had response, the median progression-free survival is 8.3 months. Compared to a reasonable 4.5 months among those with stable disease. This occurred regardless of previous progression on chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and cetuximab. To put this into greater context, the same population of patients where nivolumab and pembrolizumab were approved in platinum refractory head and neck cancers. Those response rates range from 13% to 15%, and indeed in those phase 3 trials, the standard of care arms with chemotherapy and cetuximab yielded a response rate of less than 10%. We'll also be reviewing some more of the adverse events seen with tipifarnib, and the majority of which were of grade 3 AEs were hematological and were managed with best supportive care. The 600 milligram twice daily we found has been more generally better tolerated as well. And these results have spurred the initiation of a pivotal study that's now ongoing, evaluating tipifarnib in HRAS mutant head and neck cancers with a variant allele frequency of 20% or greater. Of course, there's still a need for this HRAS mutant patient population, and we are exploring opportunities to combine tipifarnib either with immunotherapy, chemotherapy, or targeted agents, particularly in the patients who have less than a 20% HRAS mutant allele frequency. And with that, I can happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ho. Again, if you're on the phone, please press star 1. In the meantime, is there anyone here in the room that has a question? Yes. Please state your name and media outlet for the
Dropout Biotech Strategy blog. If for Dr. Ho, if tipifarnib dysregulates CXCL12 secretion, and I think you presented a poster at the annual meeting, ACR annual meeting, is it still acting through this signaling mechanism in head and neck cancer?
Well, I think the preclinical data we have in our PDX models where we're comparing wild-type to mutant HRAS head and neck cancers and the effects of tipifarnib really demonstrates that the target here is the HRAS mutation itself. As I alluded to before, the preclinical data that, you know, got us interested in this at Memorial was based upon thyroid cancer models of HRAS mutations. And there again, we demonstrated that even the mechanism of acquired resistance to tipifarnib in those models were focused on the MAP kinase pathway, which again argues to us that that's the right target for this HRAS mutant solid tumor group. Having said that, we know that a lot of farnesylation is relevant to a lot of different other proteins in the cell, and then you mentioned the CXCL12 mechanism of action, so there can be a variety of other anti-cancer mechanisms here, but at least in the HRAS mutant context, and particularly with our allele frequency data, I think we're pretty confident it's targeting the MAP kinase pathway in this case.
Great, thank you. Any other questions in the room? Okay, and we have no questions online, so we'll move on to our next presentation.
Thank you. So I have pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Pasiani, from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, who's going to present the Phase 1 clinical trial evaluating the pharmacokinetics, safety, and clinical activity of MRTX849, a mutant-selective molecule KRAS G12C inhibitor in advanced solid tumors.
Thanks, Bill, and thank you. I want to thank the organizers for inviting us to be able to present in this forum about our study of MRTX849. So just before I get to the slides, I'll just mention a few words about the preclinical data on MRTX849, which you'll hear more about today in the presentations as well as the publication, as was alluded to. But this is a highly selective mutant-specific KRAS G12C inhibitor that's effective across a broad range of preclinical models. And in the preclinical studies, leads to essentially complete target inhibition, G12C inhibition, and shutdown of MAP kinase signaling, and associated with efficacy across cell line and patient-derived xenograft models, 65% of all models have demonstrating a response, and about 75% of all lung cancer models demonstrating a response to the agent. So with that in mind, this agent was taken forward to the clinic, and this is the design of the phase 1-2 study of MRTX849. So patients were eligible for this study if they had a solid tumor with a KRAS G12C mutation based on a sponsor-approved test, had unresectable or metastatic disease, had no available treatment with curative intent, had no active brain metastases, and the endpoints of the study included safety, PK/PD, as well as clinical activity. The dose escalation schema is shown on the right-hand side. This was using a single-patient accelerated titration strategy. So a patient started, the first patient started at the 150 milligram dose, and then single patients were subsequently dose escalated. And when the level above the prior level cleared, the patients below that could be dose escalated to the next level as shown on the right-hand side. Ultimately reaching the 1200 milligram QD level as well as the 600 milligram twice daily level, which is the level, which is the dose moving forward into the expansion. What we'll present today are data on 17 patients that have been enrolled. 12 of those patients are evaluable for a response at this point, with the data cutoff being at October 11th, 2019. This shows the treatment-related AEs that have been found to date. Of note, the maximum tolerated dose of MRTX-849 has not been reached yet. At the 600 milligram twice daily dose, one DLT was observed, which was in a patient that developed a grade 3 amylase increase as well as a grade 4 lipase increase. These were isolated enzyme elevations without evidence of clinical pancreatitis. A second toxicity or intolerance was also observed at the 1200 milligram daily dose. This was due to capsule burden intolerance. The drug is administered at 100 milligram capsule, so 12 capsules became intolerable for this individual to take. If you look in the tables, this summarizes all of the toxicities. Most of the toxicities here are grade 1 and 2 toxicities, notably diarrhea, nausea, as well as some LFT abnormalities. A few grade 3 toxicities have been observed, including fatigue in one individual, decreased appetite in one individual, as well as dyspnea in another individual. again, you can see the distribution of some of the other toxicities and in the number of individuals they have been observed to date. This is the clinical activity of the 12 evaluable patients, and just to orient yourselves a little bit here, the waterfall plot is color-coded based on the dose that the patients received. So the 600 milligram twice daily dose, which the majority of patients have received, is the in dark blue, with the other doses in the different colors. And on the top there are the different diseases of the individuals. The majority of patients here have non-small cell lung cancer, 6 of the patients, 4 patients have colorectal cancer, and 2 patients have appendiceal carcinoma. To date, 4 partial responses have been observed. One patient with colon cancer, and this was a confirmed partial response, and in 3 patients with non-small cell lung cancer. One of those 3 have been subsequently confirmed to be a confirmed response, but this happened after the data cutoff just last week. You can see there's also stable disease in the rest of the patients, and no patient has had progressive disease here as their primary response to therapy. So with that, I will stop and take questions.
Great. Thank you. Please press star 1 on the phone. Is there anyone in the room that would like to ask a question? Okay. Well, we have 3 very comprehensive presentations today, so much so your questions were all answered. Thank you, Dr. Sellers. Do you have any final comments?
This just sort of emphasizes the excitement for this meeting of what's happening in the cancer field in general and in particular in the RAS pathway. So we look forward to all of your presentations, and maybe we'll ask some more questions at the live session.
So I spoke too soon. There is a delay. Just when you thought. Jacob Pleiss from Vantage is on the line, and he has a question for you, Dr. Yanni.
Yes, hi everyone. Thank you, Dr. Anna. Quick question. So the 2 partial responses that have not been confirmed, can you say whether they are capable of being confirmed later?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part. The 2 partial responses that have not been confirmed.
Yeah, are they capable of being confirmed later?
Oh, yes. Are they capable of being confirmed later? Yes. It's just that it's early on in the study. They just have not reached their second scan. They're still on study therapy.
Okay, sure. Okay, so they're still alive. Okay. And also a broad question. I guess a lot of people are going to be looking at this data set and comparing it against ANG-510. Is there any way you can help us understand you know, are these results meaningfully different from Amgen's data, or is it, you know, pretty much an inline level of safety and efficacy?
Well, I think one limitation of our study at the moment is that it's still pretty early on, and I think once more patients are enrolled in this study as well as the Amgen study, I think you can make those comparisons, even though cross-trial comparisons are sometimes difficult to do. But I think it's encouraging that both agents are showing clinical activity for a disease where we have not had targeted therapies before.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jacob, for your question, for Dr. Yanni's response. Okay, so
could I ask a question too? Sorry.
Oh, Annette, please, Brindle. Annette. Go ahead.
Annette Brindle from BioWorld. I'm just a little slow. KRAS used to be the poster child for undruggability, right? And now it seems like there are quite a number of, you know, there's Amgen and there's your drug, but there's also, you know, several posters of people working on drugging the SOS interaction. Are there technological advances that have led to this ability, or why can we drug this now when we used to not be able to? And if there are specific things you can point to, could that be used to drug other undruggables? And do you have any favorites there for what you think might, might yield to these methods?
So I think the insight into drugging KRAS directly comes from the pivotal studies from Kevan Shokat's laboratory. And really the key there is not only finding a unique site of binding into KRAS, but also using a covalent inhibitor that directly binds the cysteine. And that's why, of course, the therapies that are directly targeting KRAS only target the G12C variant of KRAS, because that's the only one with the cysteine. And there, of course, you can get irreversible binding, which you can't for the other mutants. So I think that was one insight that strategy that has led for this to be possible, whereas previously, as you point out, it was felt to be an undruggable target because one could not develop an inhibitor, a reversible inhibitor that could outcompete binding in the cell. So, and of course, then that has led to other areas of interest in targeting other proteins, as you mentioned, SOS1, SHP2, others in the area. I think given the clinical impact of KRAS mutant cancer, not just lung cancer, but all cancers. It is the most common oncogenic alteration in all of cancer. So I think that there continues to be a need to develop new and novel approaches here because it would have major impact for treatment of cancer.
Maybe historically one comment there, because I think, Posse, you mentioned the covalent nature of this inhibitor. And historically, there was a period of time where covalent inhibitors got a very bad reputation in the pharmaceutical industry for causing liver injury due to modification of off-target proteins and immune reactions in the liver, and that kind of killed covalent inhibitors for a period of time. And then maybe Posse could also comment, maybe ibrutinib was sort of a rebirth, which turned out to be a covalent inhibitor of BTK. That was at least one of the ones that sort of ignited that field again.
Ibrutinib and the early EGFR inhibitors, afatinib, dacomitinib, others, now, of course, osimertinib, all covalent inhibitors, neratinib and breast cancer. So there have been a number of these that have now made it successful, and I think people are now more comfortable with that approach.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, well, thank you for everyone's comments and presentations today. This concludes our media briefing. If you need any additional information, slides, embargo information, press releases, abstracts, manuscripts, you know where to reach me, as well as Matthew Burns. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.